Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we're on the trail of new technologies, taking stock of some of the interesting innovations that may not pop up in the headlines, but have the potential to sometimes subtly, sometimes powerfully change the way we experience the world. We'll start in the digital arena, where video game players are assuming the role of professional athletes. For most consumers, a round of Halo is purely recreational. For an elite few, playing video games is an ultra-competitive and potentially lucrative career path.
On average, I'd say I play about 6 hours a day, like actual train, 6 hours a day. I think competitive gaming can be considered a sport because you look at like Korea, for instance. StarCraft 2 over there is kind of like what the NFL is for USA.
Dan Sherlong there, talking about his career as a professional gamer at a recent MLG or Major League Gaming event in North Carolina. The BBC's Matt Danzico attended the competition where international gaming champions square off for big money in front of big crowds and millions watching online. The event prompted Matt to ask whether pro gamers are our 21st century athletes. It's a question that piqued our curiosity, so we invited him to tell us what he found.
I think what's interesting here is, you know, this idea of a sport being something physical. Now, you know, as we sort of transition into a digital sphere, all of us are spending much more time on our mobiles and our desktops. As the idea of a physical environment changes, websites are now, you know, they could be viewed as our rooms. Facebook is, you know, an arena full of all of your friends. You know, the idea of what is an athlete has to change. Why can't an athlete be an avatar running around a digital space?
So when you went to the MLG conference, this was the Major League Gaming event in Raleigh, North Carolina, you spoke to a number of pro gamers. In the lead, we heard from Dan, nicknamed Vibe, talking about his intense training regime. Vibe also mentioned in South Korea that it's like the NFL there. What's going on in South Korea?
Video gaming, pro video gaming, or esports, as they're called, is absolutely huge. I mean, these pro video game players are stopped in the middle of the streets and mauled by fans. I mean, there are something along the lines of 6 different television networks that air video games being played by pro gamers on the television screen, sort of like walkthroughs, live at all times of the day and night.
And I guess they're very wealthy, too. What's the prize money like at contests like the one in Raleigh, for example?
I think it was $200,000 for first place. And you have to realize the MLG event that I went to in Raleigh is not the largest event in the country. I mean, this is small potatoes compared to what's going on in the rest of the country and world. It's not ridiculous to hear about prize money being at the level of $1 million.
Wowie. Well, like pro sports, pro gaming has commentators and analysts at their events. And viewers can watch key replays on Major League Gaming's website. Here's just a sample.
Up that large force and is going straight up for a drop. So right now we do see that factory is nearly completed. There is going to be a drop inside the main base. A huge mailing hit, able to kill up some of those Marines. But look at this, a multi-pronged drop by Marine King. Gonna try and make it work here.
Whoa, and he manages to get the Baneling, and it looks like the Zerglings do not quite do enough damage in time, and Mutilus are in production. The stim is still about 15 seconds out. Marine King.
Who are these commentators, Matt?
So these commentators, they're former pro gamers for the most part. So, you know, the industry is really new. I mean, it hasn't been around that long at all. And so these individuals who are called casters among gamers, that's sort of the lingo, these casters were gamers about 5 to 10 years ago, pro gamers. Mm-hmm. And as they started to get a bit older, you know, into maybe their late 30s, they started to, I think, question, you know, where is this all headed? And so they decided to attempt to make a living off of being a type of sports commentator, but for professional video games. And so they sit behind a large curtain a lot of times at these events, which they tour and they go to around the country. And they're sort of sitting at a desk like you'd see on ESPN or something like that. And they're sitting at a desk and they're commenting. And then they have a live stream just for themselves talking about strategy of the games being played in the other room.
I'm wondering, Matt, if the growth of pro gaming and the sort of esports growth, does that mean anything for people who will never play video games?
I think what it means for them, you know, it's the same as let's say, golf. I don't watch golf myself, but of course I see it everywhere. It's a large industry. It could bring in a lot of money. There is a stadium that has been proposed in the city of Los Angeles by, I believe, a company called Riot. And Riot is planning on making the first professional video game stadium. And I think that's just an indicator of how huge it's going to be and how many possibilities are out there to, one, get involved with the industry, and two, to maybe profit from it.
And it'll be streamed to a screen near you. Matt Danzico, reporter and producer for the BBC, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
While some gamers may aspire to fill stadiums, game designers may hope to find their work in another public space, art museums. The Museum of Modern Art in New York City has installed 14 video games into its permanent collection. Jamin Warren is founder of the video game arts and culture magazine Killscreen. He helped the project along by creating a short list of games for consideration. MoMA came under fire from some corners for elevating the status of the video game to art. Jamin talked with us about how MoMA's design curator, Paola Antonelli, defended the acquisition.
I think for starters, anytime you fall into these very large, wide-reaching definitions about what is or what is not art, you're going to find yourself in a bit of trouble, simply because that definition of art, even amongst people in the art world, is a moving target. So to say that, you know, video games as an entire medium wholesale does not qualify as art, I think is a pretty facile way to think about not just art, but also the nature of games. So I'm happy with MoMA that we've moved past this conversation of whether or not video games are or aren't art, but which games qualify as art, and really highlighting what types of titles are appropriate for a museum setting.
So what they've chosen for titles are 14 games for the permanent collection, eventually going up to 40. Do you have a list in front of you? Can you tell us the 14 games?
Sure. They're Pac-Man, Tetris, Another World, Myst, SimCity 2000, Vibribbon, The Sims, Katamari Damacy, EVE Online, Dwarf Fortress, Portal, Flow, Passage, and Cannibal.
So years beginning 1980, Pac-Man, and then the most recent game, Cannibal, 2009. What was the criteria for being chosen?
They fall roughly on four different categories. The first is behavior. This would be described as like mechanics. So what games do, the scenarios, the rules, incentives. Those are the things that designers kind of create from the ground up. The other would be aesthetics, which I think most people who play games respond to very highly, which is just what do games look like? And certainly it's a visual medium. There are two others that I think are a little bit more abstract. One was space, which was the space that was designed not just with the code as brick and mortar, but sort of the temporal existence of the game, kind of where it sits, mm-hmm. what kind of experiences it creates. And then the last one is time, which for anyone who plays iOS games, this is something that's actually become very interesting, I think, for game players, in that you're seeing a lot more games these days play with shorter bursts, shorter sequences. You know, I think what's great about games is that, particularly on the time question, you are making a decision about whether or not you want to engage with a medium, and so deciding how much of your time it's going to take. That's a crucial design choice on the part of game designers.
Now, the question about how one acquires a video game. I mean, this is a mass-produced item. An art collection gets, what, the cartridge, the code, the intellectual property?
The museum worked with the original creators or with the publishers of the games to essentially acquire copies of the code and the right to distribute, display the games in public. There's obviously, you know, more legal, there's more of a legal framework. But, you know, the one of the exciting things is that this is new territory that's being explored by lots of different art forms. And anytime you take in something new, it raises a host of questions. So how do you take performance art or digital art? And Paola has been very forward in terms of acquiring things that maybe would be considered unorthodox into the collection already. The acquisition of different typefaces, the at symbols. So they've been accustomed to dealing with some of the gray areas and some of the new territory that's being explored in terms of the world of acquisition.
Jamin Warren there, founder of Killscreen, a video game arts and culture magazine and website. Here's another technology you might not expect to find in a museum, the hologram, specifically the Holocaust survivor hologram. Today, the average age of a Holocaust survivor is 79 years old. For decades, the stories burned into their hearts and flesh have been retold and documented in print and video. Those personal horrors serve as warnings against such violent tyranny ever happening again. A collaborative new project aims to preserve firsthand accounts of survivors in holographic form for museum installations. Stephen D. Smith is director of the USC Shoah Foundation, the Institute for Visual History and Education, which is overseeing the hologram project called New Dimensions in Testimony.
Well, right now, if you were to go to the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., or any other Holocaust museum, what you would typically find on a day-to-day basis there is that you would have volunteer docents, Holocaust survivors, who make themselves available to talk to the public. And what we've found is that students have a range of questions that they want to ask. And they're not typically, do you remember the date of your deportation to Auschwitz? What they want to know is, do you feel revenge about, you know, what happened to you? Do you feel bitter and angry? Do you believe in God after your experience? How did you start your life all over again? How did you make your way to America? Whatever the questions are, but they're always focused around the personal reflections more than the details of history. And what we want to try and do is capture some of that, because we know that those questions will be lingering on well into the future.
I guess that answers my question about how this is different than video recording or response technology, two-dimensional stuff. It must be much more effective at kind of communicating on a human level.
Well, that's right. What we're trying to do, really, we're not trying to replicate the human being, because we can't do that. There's something very beautiful about being and real about being human, and every interaction is entirely unique. So we know that will never be replicated. What we'll be doing typically with these interviews is we'll be asking the survivor around about 500 questions. And what happens is, when I ask my question, so if I ask the question, do you believe in God after your experience? The computer system will go and look in those 500 answers and find the most closest answer to the question I asked and bring it back seamlessly so that, in fact, it feels like it's a direct answer to your question.
500 questions. I wonder, sounds like a kind of an arduous interviewing process for the survivors.
Yes, of course. Our interviewees are well into their 80s. They are wonderful people of, you know, tremendous experience, but to sit for the best part of 5 days and have questions asked is a very, very tough process. And of course, they're not easy questions to answer either, because they are really probing the heart and soul of this experience and its very lingering and traumatic effects.
The Holocaust is actually one of the most documented historical events ever, happening in the 20th century, of course. And there's testimony not just from the survivors and Jews and non-Jews and people who lived in ghettos, but Nazi soldiers and guards at the camps. What is this adding to the testimony and the historical record we already have?
It's adding a personal dimension. You know, we have a great deal of documentation about the Holocaust, and that continues because we have not even begun to scratch the surface on this horrendous period of history. But what we want to make sure that we do while there is time available to us is to have that intimate discussion about the human consequences and to ask the human questions of why, how, what does it mean, how do we as human beings struggle with this, and to turn to the survivors themselves to ask those questions, because of course time for that kind of research and that kind of conversation is now very limited.
Stephen Smith is executive director of the USC Shoah Foundation, the Institute for Visual History and Education, which is overseeing New Dimensions in Testimony. That's the program that's developing interactive 3D holograms for museums and other purposes. Now stay with us for the legal vagaries of international space law. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. For a long time, outer space was conceptually and legally a no man's land. That changed on October 4th, 1957, when the Soviet Union launched the Sputnik satellite into Earth's orbit, triggering an international space race and calls for binding laws to govern space exploration.
Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this Earth. Suddenly, it has become as much a part of 20th century life as the whir of your vacuum cleaner. It's a report from
10 years later, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 was ratified and has since facilitated smooth, peaceful interactions between nations capable of probing space. As the prospect of civilian space travel and settlement appears more accessible, international space law may be in need of revision. Joining us to discuss the field is Michael Lissner, president of the International Space Society Foundation. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
So how long after Sputnik was launched were proposals for space laws introduced?
Well, Sputnik was launched in 1957, and really at that point, they were just basically talking about who owned space or who could access space. And in fact, at that time, the Soviet Union basically had the theory that we own the territory all the way up from our ground all the way up into space. And this was a major conundrum because the United States was thinking about launching satellites as well. And the problem was, if we launch a satellite, they will say that we're invading, quote, their space every time our satellite goes over their territory.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they beat us to the punch by launching Sputnik in 1957. And they not only made a very big technical accomplishment, but they also provided a big legal accomplishment for the rest of the world. Because when Sputnik went into orbit, it started traversing over the territory of the United States and other countries as well. In fact, there was a story that after Sputnik launched, they said, well, Sputnik wasn't really revolving around the Earth. Earth was revolving around Sputnik. And that didn't hold up very well. And they basically had to concede that they created unintentionally what we call an international law customary norm that you have free access to outer space. Nobody owns it. Everybody is able to access space, even over flying over the territory of another country.
In those intervening years, though, from 1957 to 67, pretty problematic years in terms of U.S.-Soviet relations, was this all agreed upon internationally?
It was eventually. And during 57 and 67, when the Outer Space Treaty was drafted, there was a set of principles that were drafted by the United Nations. Those were actually culminated in 1967 with the Outer Space Treaty, which over 100 nations have signed, including the United States, what is now Russia, and China.
What are some of the overriding principles? I mean, the basics, sort of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967.
Well, the basic one most prominent is that outer space is the province of all mankind, meaning no one country owns outer space. It can't own the space above the territory. It can't own the moon. It can't own Mars. It can't own asteroids or any celestial bodies. It also has the principle that nations are responsible for the activities of their citizens. It also has a strict prohibition on the use of nuclear weapons in outer space as well.
All right. So how about liability? Especially we have so many commercial satellites now, you know, not sponsored by the state as they might have been in 1950s or 60s. Who would be liable then if, say, a satellite for a U.S. company re-enters the atmosphere and falls on a building in another country, for example, or if a TV satellite crashed into the Hubble telescope?
Let's address your first one, because this actually happened back in 1979. The Russians had a nuclear-powered reconnaissance satellite called Cosmos 954 that re-entered the atmosphere and landed in the northwestern territory of Canada and caused some pretty significant contamination. There is a treaty that was drafted and signed in 1972 called the Liability Convention. Now, under the Liability Convention, any object that causes damage on the surface of the Earth, the country that launched that is strictly liable. The two countries get together through their embassies, through their diplomatic organs, and they basically communicate to one another, hey, this has been a problem, and they negotiate back and forth through their diplomatic channels to make a resolution. This is what happened with Cosmos 954. Essentially, the Canadians found the wreckage. They identified it as belonging to that satellite. They went to the Russians through their embassy saying, hey, this caused some damage. And eventually they came to an agreement where the Russians paid costs for cleanup and other associated damage.
Mm-hmm. How about crashing into other space junk, the other scenario?
Well, that is the unknown. Under that scenario, it isn't a strict liability standard. It's almost like, let me say, a comparative negligence standard like we have here in New Hampshire for, say, an automobile accident.
Mm-hmm.
Each country or each party is apportioned damages based on their liability. Now, back in 2009, we actually had an incident where two satellites crashed over Siberia. They physically collided. There was a satellite from Iridium LLC, which provides cell phone services, and a dead Russian communication satellite. Afterwards, there was a lot of finger pointing. the Russian Federation blamed Iridium LLC. Iridium LLC wasn't saying much about it. And there was a lot of back and forth, but it was never resolved who was really at fault, because at that time we didn't have what we call space situational awareness to really look at the tapes and understand what happened and who was responsible or how to apportion damages.
So I guess that leads to another question that maybe you can enlighten us on. What happens about ownership of that stuff that's just floating around in the atmosphere?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have an answer. Nobody has an answer yet. That's kind of the billion-dollar question. Who's responsible for all that junk up there? And this all goes back to the treaties themselves. The treaties, when they were drafted in the context of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. And both countries wanted to make sure they were ambiguous as possible so that they would have enough maneuverability so as to be able to perform their own national security functions, you know, without being constrained too much by the language of the treaties themselves.
Michael Listener is with us. He's president of the International Space Society Foundation. He's a consultant on international space law. Now, Michael, while we were prepping for this segment, we read about a man named Dennis Hope. Now, he, in 1980, citing a loophole in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, claimed ownership of the moon and has been selling it off in small parcels ever since. Now, I know you know about this guy. I guess he's famous in your circles, or infamous, let's say. We gave him a call and asked him how much an acre of his lunar property goes for.
If you were to buy a piece of property over the internet, it would cost you $36.50. If you bought five of those, it'd be $132.50. So far, we've sold about 675 celebrities like George Lucas, Ron Howard, Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman, Clint Eastwood, three former presidents of the United States, Carter, Reagan, and George W. Bush are all property owners. We have 1,800 major corporations that have purchased land from us, including the Hilton and Marriott hotel chains. I've had no governmental agencies challenge my claim of ownership in any regard whatsoever. I have a lot of individuals on the planet that are smarter than I am that tell me I can't do this. I guess in some regards I'm opportunistic, but it was an area of life that when I got involved in it, it seemed to be relevant at the time, and now it has more relevance than ever.
That's Dennis M. Hope. He's alleged owner of the moon and self-styled owner of the Lunar Embassy and president of the Galactic Government. So is what he's doing legal, Michael?
I don't know. That's a good question. And again, lots of good questions, but not really a lot of answers. He's right. A few of my colleagues, they do not like Dennis and what he does, but he's absolutely right. No government agencies have come in and stopped him. The UN has chosen to just ignore him. But he is correct. The Outer Space Treaty does have a loophole because it says no governments can claim extraterrestrial ownership of the moon. Or the moon or asteroids. Dennis has latched onto the loophole in the fact that we haven't ratified the Moon Treaty, which the Moon Treaty basically says no private individual can own the moon or any other celestial body. See, that's the big catch with the Moon Treaty.
So could there be a legitimate battle down the road, let's say, from Dennis Hope's claim or stake on the moon?
It's kind of been addressed already. There was one court case back about 10 years ago called Nimitz. And basically what this gentleman did is he claimed the Eros asteroid. And NASA sent a probe up there around the year 2000 to orbit the Eros asteroid. And he actually landed on it. And he tried to give NASA a parking ticket. And so, of course, NASA refused. And, you know, he brought it to court and actually got up, I believe, to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And his claim was, you know what, the Outer Space Treaty says we can own private property. We're not a signatory of the Moon Treaty. Therefore, it's not the law of the land in the United States, so I can do this. The court went through and just decided that nobody had the standing to actually give him the deed as well. They never really addressed really whether or not there was a loophole or whether the Moon Treaty was applicable law or not. Now, a lot of my colleagues just jump right on Nimitz. Oh, this is proof. My opinion is that until somebody takes him to court and actually determines once and for all that he can't do this, he's probably going to do well in business for the next few years.
So as technology is advancing, and obviously a lot more private industries and private companies are getting interested in space travel and space even colonization, obviously, there's some need for revision in these laws. What do you think the future holds for international space law?
I wouldn't say so much a revision as so much an evolution. Commercial space has been a huge issue for the past few years, to the point where we have private companies who are providing launch services to the government, to NASA itself. We also have companies that are doing suborbital flights to Taurus. Now, this is interesting because now we're taking spaceflight laws out of the hands of the federal government and we're putting it into the individual states. So it's a game changer. We're definitely in new territory. We're going to be making a lot of new international law as this goes orbital, but I think a lot of it's going to be more what we call customary, as in law created through practice instead of law created through treaty.
Michael Lissner, president of the International Space Safety Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills. Put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown.
You can discover more about international space law and hear our full interview with the alleged owner of the moon, Dennis Hope, at wordofmouthradio.org.
And may God's love be with you.
Lift off.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
While some sprint forward to keep pace with advances in technology, others choose to stay behind, preferring to live by the habits and tools of the past. During the first draft of the internet, users communicated very differently than they do today, not through Facebook or email, but on simple platforms with funky names like IRC and NNTP, systems which actually live on today. Todd Bookman brings us the story of a group of holdouts, people who chose not to engage in current forms of social media and instead chat in online forums without pop-up ads, animated banners, or status updates.
Before Facebook, before Google, even before Al Gore, there was an internet. The 1980s internet, perhaps best portrayed in the movie War Games, starring Matthew Broderick.
Shall we play a game?
Oh...
I think I missed them.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love to. How about global thermonuclear war?
Wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess?
The story goes, Broderick takes his old-fashioned telephone, puts the handset on a cradle modem, and uses his computer to connect to a military supercomputer. They play tic-tac-toe, things go awry, global thermonuclear war almost breaks out. Sounds outdated, right? Obsolete? Turns out, not quite. Today, that version of the internet, of people communicating through simple lines of text and commands, is still very much alive. To see it in action, I went down into one user's basement, or technically speaking, his parents' basement.
And how do you pronounce your name?
I always type it, so there's never really any need to pronounce it, but I guess Bullywiff. So you might say it. Yeah. That's it, I guess.
Bullywiff is this guy's handle, his screen name. The 23-year-old college student asked me to not reveal his identity. He's a member of an online community called SDF, which is sort of like Facebook, Gmail, Craigslist, and a gaming site all rolled into one. But there aren't videos or pictures or pop-ups, and most users remain anonymous.
This is a lot more elegant, I think. This is just text. There's no mouse. It's just all in a command line. Using a mouse and having windows and dragging stuff around it's distracting.
The screen is pretty boring to look at if you don't understand this stuff. Instead of websites, users are accessing a shared operating system. They can chat, email, and post within the system, but only by typing in commands. SDF has been around since 1987 and hasn't changed much since then. It currently has about 30,000 members, but at one time, this type of computing was the internet.
They were extremely popular. They were like the alternative to AOL and CompuServe back in the early days. But nowadays, they're, you know, very, very obscure.
Rob Fleischman is a computer scientist and internet architect. He says there is a very good reason why these shared systems faded away.
These little areas of the internet that are not particularly popular are great places for nefarious characters.
Porn, pirated software, and illegal file sharing took over this pre-web internet. Now, most of that business has migrated onto the mainstream web. But what hasn't changed about these systems is that users like Bullywiff want to remain anonymous. This stands in stark contrast to what is happening on the web. More than anything else, Facebook has dramatically altered how we share information online. Pictures, relationship status, schedules, everything is up for grabs. It's a world of oversharing. And even though we know companies are monitoring that data and selling it and using it to target ads, we seem to be all right with that. Rob Fleischman says that this new openness actually makes more sense than the alternative.
If I use a handle, am I going to be having conversations with people that I care about? It really depends on what I want. And there's a price to be gained by giving up your privacy. By giving up my privacy, I can connect with my old high school and college friends.
It should be said that, by and large, SDF users like Bullywiff are not engaging in seedy activities online. For them, this is a community. Back in the 80s, when users still had to use landline telephones to connect, they would usually only communicate with other computers that had a local number. Nobody wanted to pay long-distance charges. And because other users were in your area, it was common for them to get together in person. Online friends actually became real friends. Bullywiff told me that is still happening.
Yeah, actually, I've seen a couple posts, people saying, you know, all right, anyone in this area, let's meet up in this bar and hang out. And, you know, I think that would be really cool. I haven't come across anyone in Concord, New Hampshire. If I did, I'd love to meet up with them.
For now, Bullywiff is content meeting new friends online. While he showed me some of his favorite chat rooms and different old-school games he plays on SDF, I asked him if this type of internet surfing is really only something a tech geek could love. I didn't mean to stereotype, but it just seemed to me like that term was a good way to, well, stereotype this whole thing.
The tech geek that's kind of become chic recently, like, I don't know, you see people in Wired magazine, there's like a specific style of clothing they wear, a specific way they do their hair, and they identify themselves as tech geeks and write about the latest Apple gadgets and products. The people I've met with on SDF seem to just be computer literate people who are genuinely interested in this shared experience. You know, they might refer to themselves as tech geeks, or they might just refer to themselves as people. Probably most often they would just refer to themselves as people.
These aren't normal people, though. Remember, these are internet users that actually understand how the internet works. Rob Fleischman told me that this type of computing will always exist. There will always be users that are willing to trade the bells and whistles of a website for the hard elegance of code. But because it requires a level of knowledge that most users will never seek or obtain, it will likely stay limited to the basement. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up, the mainstreaming of the unregulated e-cigarette. Sales of what's being marketed as the safe way to get a nicotine fix are smoking. We'll find out what's in them, or maybe not, when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our program on culture catching up to technology continues with an innovation that gets a jump on a bad habit. Cigarette smoking is now banned in most public spaces in America. Smokers are forced to huddle outside of office buildings and bars and even house parties to get their fix. Well, that was until the nicotine vaporizer, or e-cigarette, came along.
You know what the most amazing thing about this cigarette is? It isn't one. Introducing the Enjoy King, the first electronic cigarette with the look, feel, and flavor of the real thing. Finally.
That ad, featuring a square-jawed Marlboro Man type, smoking is a throwback to a time before 1971, when cigarette ads were banned from TV. They are still strictly regulated in other media. For electronic cigarettes, however, it is still the Wild West. Chris Robbins wrote about this relatively new, unregulated product that some investors are betting will overtake traditional cigarettes in the next decade. Chris is editor and reporter at Gothamist.com. He wrote about the growing popularity of the e-cigarette and described it for us.
Sometimes it looks like, startlingly so, a regular combustible cigarette. Other times it looks like a pen or some other sort of handheld device. But essentially it's a tube filled with liquid nicotine, tobacco flavorings, other flavorings such as banana or ice cream or cinnamon. It also has an atomizer powered by a lithium battery that's either disposable or rechargeable that atomizes that nicotine into vapor that we can inhale and then get your nicotine fix.
You went to a swanky party, apparently, at the Janes Hotel, and it's a nightclub sponsored by the Enjoy e-cigarette brand. What was it like? I mean, were people just sitting there smoking e-cigarettes?
Yeah, it really was, and this was, to me, totally their intention was. It's a throwback to Mad Men era New York, if you will, where you walk in, there are folks puffing away on these things, holding martini glasses. There was definitely some tentativeness on the part of some of the attendees because, you know, you pick one up and you don't really know what to do with it. Like, do you need to flip a switch? Do you need to, you know, plug it in the wall? But, you know, it didn't take but a few drinks for people to sort of warm up to the idea of puffing away on these things.
It's so funny to imagine. I mean, especially bans on cigarettes in most bars everywhere in the country. But another thing that you usually don't see is tobacco-related celebrity endorsements. We found quite a few, including this one from actor Stephen Dorff. And here he's making the pitch for this e-cigarette Blue.
Negative one, I'm tired of being a walking ashtray. Negative two, I'm tired of feeling guilty every time I want to light up. I'm Stephen Dorff. I've been a smoker for 20 years. And I just found the smarter alternative.
Enjoy, another manufacturer, sued the FDA in 2010 to prevent them from being subject to regulation. There is nicotine in them, though. How did they make their case?
Basically, the FDA said you have to stop importing this device that is a nicotine device that people are using because, you know, you should go through the normal regulations and testing that devices like nicotine gum or nicotine patch have to go through. Enjoy disagreed. They said this is a tobacco device. It's not a device used for smoking cessation. It's not a medicine. It's not a drug. And they won. And so what happened was the FDA was forced to make them go under the regulations as stipulated by the 2009 Tobacco Control Act. But that's taking a really long time. So in the interim, you see, you know, this proliferation of e-cigarette companies being able to do whatever they want while the federal government sort of plays catch-up and tries to decide whether or not this is really a legitimate thing to help people quit smoking or whether or not this is a continuation of this, you know, smoking culture that ultimately is harmful to public health.
Well, you just alluded to something. You know, e-cigarette companies are obviously marketing themselves as a healthier alternative to normal cigarettes. Consumers are buying it. So what do public health or medical experts think about these?
They're pretty divided. Some folks who are on the side that these should be more regulated, they point to the fact that nicotine is a harmful substance, that the other chemicals in these e-cigarettes, including propylene glycol, which is found in fog machines, they're saying we have no idea what the synergistic effect of this device will yield. We don't know about secondhand vapor. You know, we don't know about the end-of-life stage with regard to the batteries in these things. The other side of the equation, though, is that smoking is a public health epidemic and that the rate of success for these other devices, such as nicotine gum, nicotine patches, is not very good. It's a 90% failure rate, as a matter of fact. So these people are harm reduction advocates. They'll say, on the whole, this is clearly better than smoking a combustible cigarette. Why not encourage people to use these to get off, you know, the real thing, so to speak? And then in the interim, we can sort of figure out the effects on people.
You did talk to a bunch of e-cigarette smokers and at least one tobacco investor who does think that they will catch fire, if I can use that phrase. You tried them yourself. Now, what do you think, Chris? Will e-cigarettes overtake the traditional cigarette market?
I think it's hard to say now, and it really depends upon how the FDA approaches the product. If the FDA believes, as many former smokers and current e-cigarette smokers do, that this is sort of the key to helping people quit smoking, it gives people that feeling and allows them to maintain the ritual that they're really hooked on just as much as the nicotine, I think we'll definitely see them overtaking combustible cigarettes, whether it's 10 years, 20 years. You know, taxes on cigarettes are only going to get higher, the number of places where you can use them are only going to get smaller. Mm. In that respect, I really do think that e-cigarettes do have the potential to become cigarettes of the future, I guess you could say.
Chris Robbins, editor and reporter for Gothamist.com, thanks so much for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
You can check out his article, Unregulated, Addictive, and Enticing. E-cigarettes suck in smokers, but risks remain, by linking to it at our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. The internet is a technological forum for public debate, cross-cultural exchange, and their very opposites. Reader comments sometimes take on characteristics more like the Roman forum. It's in the comments section where sniping, shaming, and mean-spirited insults are pelted like so many rotten tomatoes onto a stage. A study published in the Journal of Computer-Mediated Communication measured the influence of reader comments on the articles they describe. Dietram Scheufele, science and communication professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, is one of the authors of the study. Dietram, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
You and your colleagues came away from the study with the term the nasty effect. Can you summarize for us what that means?
Well, a nasty effect is actually something that's very subtle in many ways. It's not something that relates to us making arguments or giving new information or trying to convince each other that we're right or wrong. But it's actually an effect that's simply based on the tone with which we do that. So the level of politeness or the lack of civility, for that matter, and how that really reshapes what we think we just read and what we've just learned.
Let's dig into that a little and talk about how your study was done. It was based on a fictitious post about a scientific study. Now, what was this particular story designed to reveal?
So what this story was all about, it described an aspect of nanotechnology, so this new technology that we invested billions and billions of dollars in as a country, and that has both upsides and downsides, potential risks associated with it, and a lot of course, economic and other benefits. And the study described those in a fairly balanced fashion. It was actually written by a science writer who we paid to write this very neutrally. And we gave them to a national sample of respondents, and everybody saw the exact same story. And that story then was followed by a set of comments. Those comments also, again, highlighted the pluses and the minuses, and the content, the arguments presented in the comments, again, were exactly the same. Everybody saw the same. The only difference was that some groups were exposed to a more civil version of this, and some people were exposed to a less civil or a more impolite version of this. So those folks heard the same arguments, but maybe there was a you idiot built into it. And that small tweak, just that level of politeness, changed how people then reinterpreted the story that they just read and also looked at the technology in a more negative light.
Huh. You found that it was actually more polarizing. People were more likely to take sides. Why does this occur? Any theories on that?
Well, I think it's in many ways it mirrors what we've seen in this country as far as the general discourse has been going. And I think if we just look back, for example, to the healthcare debate, the issue with the healthcare debate was not that we disagreed on the arguments in favor or against them. That was not the problem. Disagreement, in fact, is a very good thing, as a lot of research shows. But the issue with the healthcare debate was also the fact that we didn't just disagree with certain aspects. We also then proceeded to immediately call Obama, Hitler, or a Nazi, and whatever else. And the same thing, of course, worked on both sides. So I think it's really that tone that pushes us into our respective camps and makes us listen less to the other side or just discount that completely.
Well, you did use a science story for your example, or your experiment, mm-hmm. rather. Do you anticipate this nasty effect applying to any sort of reporting?
Probably even more so, yes, absolutely. We used the science story in many ways because the science story, of course, is not really all that open to interpretation. For other issues open to interpretation, we'll see that effect even more.
Well, there have been plenty of proposals to moderate or monitor or maybe even pre-approve comments before posting. Now, what effect do you think that would have on the nasty effect, this open forum? I mean, are we beyond the point where we can put the toothpaste back in the tube?
In many ways, I think we can't, and in many ways, we shouldn't. I do think that one of the key advantages of this new media environment is that we have this open debate. It used to be that we have mass media that are very top-down, where people read stories that were written for them by journalists. Now we have a much more open discourse among journalists, policymakers, and the audiences. And I think that's not a bad thing necessarily, but we all, I think, have a lot of learning to do in particular audiences. And we haven't really figured out the best models yet. Some news sites or some blogs have used rating systems with thumbs up and thumbs down, and people can report abuse of the system and so on and so forth. But I think it's a matter of us learning how to interact in these online forums.
Dietram Scheufele, Johnny Ross Professor in Science and Communication at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You can read more on the study online at wordofmouthradio.org. Keep your comments nice. The pace and onslaught of media choices in the mobile technology era can be dizzying, overwhelming, even oppressive. That may be the reason why rewatching a favorite movie on TV can feel so comforting.
Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe?
Don't mess with the bull, young man. You'll get the horns.
Or the relief of diving into an all-day Law and Order marathon. Researchers have found that watching reruns does not only kill time, it may actually be good for you. Tom Jacobs is science writer with Pacific Standard.
Okay, this is a study done by psychologist Jay Derrick. She's at the Research Institute on Addictions at the University of Buffalo. Her study is one of quite a number that have been done in recent years about impulse control and the fact that we now think impulse control is a limited resource.
In other words, your self-control is like a gas tank that gets depleted the more you use it. So if you've resisted that slice of birthday cake at the office all afternoon, you are more likely to give into a big bowl of ice cream after dinner at home.
The question then becomes, how do you replenish your self-control? Once it's depleted, how do you get it back? And she found a surprising answer to that, which is watching reruns on television.
Smelly cat, what are they feeding you? Everybody, smelly cat.
Okay, then, how did researchers determine that plunking oneself on the couch for an hour in front of familiar characters and laugh tracks helps recharge your batteries?
The shorthand answer, I think, is the researchers stressed a bunch of people out by giving them a deliberately difficult assignment. They had to write an essay without using the letters A or I. Then half of those people were asked to describe their favorite TV show. Okay, afterwards, everybody then took a subsequent test that required a great amount of self-discipline. And they found that the people who had thought about and talked about their favorite television show did far better than the others. Getting into the world of their favorite TV show, even for a couple minutes, put them in a better mood and seems to have restored their self-control to its normal level.
Reruns as restorative? We wanted to find out whether, with all that's available to watch, people still turn to reruns. So we conducted a completely unscientific poll around the office and then hit the streets of Concord to ask people if they revisit tried and true shows and why.
George Lopez.
Yeah, I like Family Guy.
Probably Seinfeld.
Nothing for you!
Probably Two and a Half Men. I could watch that all day.
You also like to watch Family Guy.
Oh, Family Guy.
Over.
I could watch Family Guy all day.
Doctor Who, Buffy, Arrested Development.
Is there like a movie that you've watched over and over
the
again?
Princess Bride.
Hello.
I can quote it easily.
My name is Inigo Montoya.
That and Clue. 1+1+2+1.
One thing that I've actually started to really do with Scrubs was I would watch the show and I'd sort of not pay attention to what was in the front and I'd just watch the background and I started to notice how like they had the same kind of B-roll list of people always like walking through in the back and it's like exactly these carbon copy things. It's just like this random doctor guy walking through, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty funny.
It's like all of a sudden this hospital's a police state.
Wait, next thing you know, they're going to be charging doctors for candy at the gift shop.
They do charge doctors for candy at the gift shop, Elliot.
You can just know that you're going to enjoy what it is that you're watching, and you can spend that time laughing as opposed to wondering if you're going to laugh or wondering what the plot line is. You already know what it is, and you can just sit back and enjoy it. It's a lot less energy.
Thank you to everyone willing to admit their guilty pleasures. Who knew it could be so good for you? As for Pacific Standard's Tom Jacobs, who told us about the rerun study, what's his favorite program for boosting self-control?
Well, I'm a Simpsons fan, so especially some of the classic seasons from the 90s, yeah.
Thinking along the lines of no TV and no beer, make Homer something something.
Go crazy.
Don't mind if I do.
I wish that I knew what I know now. When I was younger, I wish that I knew what I know now.
And with all the old favorites, we say goodbye for today. In our digitally saturated, hyper-connected, and mechanized world, we are all trailing technology in some way or another. Inside of this information-rich age is an awful lot to demand your attention and a heck of a lot of noise. We know your listening time is valuable, and we appreciate it. We invite you to join the Word of Mouth community on Facebook and Twitter to stay connected with other listeners. That's Word of Mouth Radio on Facebook and at Word of Mouth on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please do join us again for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent,
and Bill Berry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.